Welcome to the Federal Societies Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Societies Corporations, Securities, and Antitrust Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, June 13, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we discuss the Puerto Rico bankruptcy case decided earlier today by the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I mention experts in the plural because we might well have two experts on our call today. We for certain have Professor David Skeel from the University of Pennsylvania. We had on the line, but seemed to have lost, at least momentarily, not announced in the announcement this morning, G. Marcus Cole. He's the William F. Baxter Visa International Professor of Law at Stanford University Law School. So what we're going to try and do is begin with Professor Skeel, get opening remarks from him, and hopefully in the interim locate Professor Cole on our line. Looks like he might be entering the call here now. So, Professor Skeel, if you'll just bear with me a second, let me see if I can unmute his phone. Do we have Professor Cole back yet?
I am trying to call in. Do you have me?
Yeah. Marcus, this is Dean.
Okay, great.
We've got you, and we've just made the introduction. So we're going to hear opening remarks from Professor Skeel of about 5 to 10 minutes, followed by opening remarks from Professor Marcus Cole, about 5 to 10 minutes. But then, as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please do be ready with those. With that, Professor Skeel, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. What I thought I would do is just give a brief background of how the case got to the Supreme Court, and then talk very briefly about the case itself, and then turn things over to my good friend Marcus Cole. So the background is that as of 1984, Puerto Rico's municipalities were and have been excluded from bankruptcy, from Chapter 9, which is the municipal bankruptcy provisions of the bankruptcy code. And the way Puerto Rico's municipalities got excluded is Congress added a definition of what a state is, and Congress said in 1984 that Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. are states for every purpose under the bankruptcy laws except who can be a debtor in Chapter 9. So it was quite clear that what the effect of this was to exclude Puerto Rico's municipalities from Chapter 9 municipal bankruptcy. Now, nobody knows why they were excluded. There's almost no legislative history on the definition of state and the exclusion of Puerto Rico, but it's quite clear Puerto Rico's municipalities are excluded from municipal bankruptcy. So against this backdrop, as Puerto Rico got into financial distress a few years ago — it actually had been in financial distress for some time, but the distress deepened — in 2014, Puerto Rico decided to take matters into its own hands, since it could not authorize its municipalities, which in Puerto Rico's case include particularly a number of public corporations, its electricity company and its water and sewer company. Since Puerto Rico could not authorize them to file for municipal bankruptcy, what it did was it passed its own restructuring law, which is usually referred to as the Recovery Act, and looks a lot like municipal bankruptcy in many respects. Almost as soon as Puerto Rico passed the Recovery Act, two bond funds challenged it, and the bond fund said that any Puerto Rico restructuring law, including the Restructuring Act, is precluded, and it's precluded by another provision in Chapter 9. There is a provision in Chapter 9, the provision is Section 903, that says — it's debated exactly what it means, but essentially it says that states can't pass their own restructuring laws. And what the bond funds argued is that in addition to Puerto Rico itself being excluded, its municipalities being excluded from Chapter 9, It also is prevented from enacting its own law by this preemption provision. Or to put it another way, Puerto Rico counts as a state for every purpose except who may be a debtor. The fact that it's not a state for the purposes of who may be a debtor means its municipalities can't use municipal bankruptcy. But Puerto Rico is a state for every other purpose, and one of the other purposes is this other provision in Chapter 9, 903, which preempts the states from enacting their own municipal restructuring laws. So the bond funds argue that not only were Puerto Rico's municipalities excluded from Chapter 9, but this preemption provision prevents Puerto Rico from enacting its own restructuring law, a Puerto Rico restructuring law like the Recovery Act. The district court agreed with the bond funds and struck down the Recovery Act. The First Circuit affirmed by a vote of 2-3, or I guess you would say it's 3-0. The two judges joined the majority opinion. There was a concurring opinion which joined the result but disagreed with the reasoning. The Supreme Court took the case, and it was argued a couple months ago, and the decision just came down today. Now, when the decision was argued, for the purposes of the argument and the decision in the case, there were only 7 justices involved. Justice Scalia, of course, had passed away earlier this year, so he was not involved. Justice Alito recused himself, so there were only 7 justices involved. And the 7 justices were the 4 liberal justices and the 3 remaining conservative justices. Now, based on this particular vote, it looked like Puerto Rico had a decent chance of winning the case, given that, in my view at least, the equities quite strongly favor Puerto Rico. It's a little surprising that the law would not give Puerto Rico any restructuring option. So as of the oral argument, it looked like Puerto Rico, which had started with a case that didn't look so promising in the Supreme Court, looked like they had a better chance. In the oral argument itself, it sounded like Puerto Rico had done quite well, and Justice Kagan in particular seemed to be quite persuaded by Puerto Rico's lawyers' argument in the oral argument. So at this point, and on another FedSoc podcast, I very confidently predicted that Puerto Rico was going to win this case. I may have even put a percentage on it, something like 70 or 75%. So one of the things I'm here to do today is to eat some crow, because Puerto Rico did not win the case, and they lost 5-2. They did not even get they lost 2 of the liberal votes, and they lost all of the conservative votes. So 5-2 vote, an opinion written by Justice Thomas. It's basically a no-nonsense, textualist, plain-meaning approach, saying if you read the provisions, Puerto Rico loses. If you read the provisions, its municipalities cannot file for Chapter 9, and Puerto Rico is a state for every other purpose that other than determining who can file for Chapter 9. That means Puerto Rico is a state for the purposes of the preemption provision, and that means Puerto Rico, like the states, cannot pass its own restructuring law. So where that leads us, and hopefully where we'll get later, is to whether Puerto Rico has other options. But at this point, what the Supreme Court has said is Puerto Rico cannot pass a restructuring law. So at that point, let me turn it over to Marcus Cole.
I agree with David for the most part, other than it's easy for me to play Monday morning quarterback with respect to the outcome, but I would not have been as confident as David, given the reasoning of the lower courts in this case. And I do want to say that I thought David gave a very good description of the procedural posture of the case and the history of the case. I do want to add one thing, though, to both his description of the Supreme Court opinion that was written by Justice Thomas, as well as his description of the history here. There are, I think, very few people in the United States who are more expert on bankruptcy history than David Skeel. So I'm a little uncomfortable challenging David on his history. But I do have to say that that the 1984 amendments that took Puerto Rico out of the category of state for purposes of 109 sub C, those 1984 amendments were designed to make the bankruptcy code, which had been ruled earlier unconstitutional, to make it comply with the Constitution. So even though we don't have a lot of legislative history on why Puerto Rico was excised from the list of states for purposes of Section 109C, we do have the context that the 1984 amendments, which are often referred to as the Manville Amendments, were designed to rescue the constitutionality of the bankruptcy code. And because it was designed to rescue the constitutionality of the bankruptcy code, I think that we can infer that there was some thought about Puerto Rico's status vis-a-vis the other states and the Constitution. And so now we come to forward to this decision today, where the court makes it very clear that a textualist reading of the statute, Section 109C, together with the exemption provisions in Section 9031, means that Puerto Rico cannot just go out and draft its own insolvency law for its own subdivisions. It simply can't do that. It doesn't have that power. But what the Supreme Court opinion makes very clear today is that the reason why Puerto Rico doesn't have that power is because Congress expressly excluded Puerto Rico from such power. And in order for Puerto Rico to exercise that power, it has to go back to Congress and ask for it. Now, it's not clear to me that Congress can or will give Puerto Rico the power to determine which of its municipalities, authorize its municipalities or subdivisions, and in this case, its utilities to file for bankruptcy under Chapter 9. But it's clear that what the court is saying is that the court is not in the position of conferring this power on to Puerto Rico, that Congress has to do it. And we can talk later about whether Congress will. We can make predictions about whether Congress will and what the limits are of what Congress can do. So, Dean, I think that's about what I wanted to add.
Terrific. Well, thank you both for joining us. I want to get the audience involved here if we can. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you're in the audience, you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. An announcement as well that we have a pretty full schedule of conference calls, telephone conference calls this week. Tomorrow we'll be discussing another Supreme Court case that came out today. That's Halo Electronics. That'll be tomorrow afternoon Eastern time. Today, of course, we're talking about the Puerto Rico case. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me start things off while we see if anybody rings in here. How much of this discussion around this case was about, in the media or otherwise, was about the who wins and who loses here? There were bondholders on one side. There were pensioners on another side. I read some things about that, and it seemed to be the press might have been playing that up. I'm always fond of observing that even if bondholders came to the bonds late when they were in distress or foreseeably in distress, that's a market I think we want to encourage so that the folks who held the bonds earlier could at least get something of a return. But having said that, I leave that question to either of you who wants to respond.
So I'm happy just to start and jump in briefly. A lot of the discussion has been about the winners and losers, both with respect to this opinion and with respect to the legislation that is pending in Congress. And the particular focus has been on whether bondholders are winners or losers. And so from that perspective, bondholders would seem to be winners with this decision, but I think that's not necessarily so in the long run scheme of things.
Professor Cole, a comment from you?
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that these discussions, particularly in the press, ignore is that the markets for these bonds exist against a backdrop. And when bonds are purchased against a backdrop where no one anticipates a territory like Puerto Rico having access to Chapter 9, what we're doing when we entertain that possibility now is to change the rules of the game or to move the goalposts after these markets have played out. So there's always, of course, there's always a risk of default on sovereign debt, but we should recognize that part of the discussion that's been ignored is the backdrop of rules against which the original investments have been made.
So here I'd like to push back on Marcus just a little bit. With the most recent, I believe, $3.5 billion issuance of Puerto Rico debt, not just its municipalities, but Puerto Rico itself, the possibility of a bankruptcy or restructuring law being passed is explicitly discussed. There, in the warning section, it says there is no bankruptcy law now, but there could be one. So I think it's unrealistic to suggest that this is a surprise to the bond market.
Yeah, not a complete surprise, but so as I said, they're always purchased against a risk, even if it wasn't articulated. It's always purchased against the risk of default, right? That risk has to be priced, but we have to recognize that there wasn't a law in place before, particularly with respect to the municipal debt, as well as with the territorial bonds. There wasn't a law in place before. And sure, the bondholders are investing against the backdrop of the possibility of a law being passed, but there wasn't a law in place.
David, Professor Skill, did you have more to say on this?
No, I agree. I mean, I think we're making a similar point from opposite perspectives. I mean, I really do think that this, even as compared to other municipal debt situations, is one where you can't be too surprised by the possibility of a restructuring law. Yeah, you know, because it people were talking about it. A lot of folks bought these bonds after these discussions had emerged. So it's not a surprise, but as Marcus said, it would be a change in the rules of the game. The only other thing I'll say is to circle back, Dean, to a comment that you made, and I suspect Marcus would agree with this. I do agree that we should not distinguish between folks who bought bonds a long time ago and folks who bought bonds more recently. I think they need to be treated the same way, and the amount you paid for a bond should not determine what your payout is.
Again, to the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. Let me ask another question. I think it was Professor Cole who alluded to the idea that Congress might do something yet to help Puerto Rico or possibly could. Let me ask for more information on that. Is that something within Congress's power? Do they run into a contracts clause issue there, or some other sort of constitutional issue possibly?
So to me, this is Marcus Cole, the contracts clause of Article 1 really only applies to the states, which is why Congress under Article 1, Section 8 can pass bankruptcy laws, right? Because bankruptcy necessarily impairs the obligations of contracts. And it would be inconsistent to say that Congress can't impair the obligations of contracts if they can also pass bankruptcy laws. So Article 1 bankruptcy clause basically applies to states. So Congress can do something here. I'm also not concerned that that what Congress does with Puerto Rico is necessarily going to set a precedent with respect to the states. I think that that Puerto Rico's situation is sui generis. Nevertheless, I'm not sure that while I think Congress has the power to do something here to rescue Puerto Rico, I'm not sure how wise it is to rescue Puerto Rico on the backs of the creditors in this particular case. It may be penny wise and pound foolish to do so, even though it's not going to be popular for the taxpayers to take a hit with respect to Puerto Rico. David actually has a plan for Congress, and I think it's an interesting plan. I have some quibbles with it.
David, Professor Skeel, you want to talk about your plan?
Sure. I assume Marcus is talking about the plan with respect to Puerto Rico. And Marcus, you can correct me if I'm talking about the wrong plan. But
no,
you are thinking about the Puerto Rico plan, and I'm having a little trouble hearing Marcus. But the proposal that I've made it with a friend and co-author, Clay Gillette, who's a law professor at NYU. The proposal that we've made, or that we made a while ago, actually looks quite a bit like the bill that's pending in Congress now. The bill is known as PROMESA, which is a bill that would allow Puerto Rico to restructure. And it also would have a financial control board. So the bill has, and the proposal I've made, both have two main pieces. The first piece is put a financial control board in place that would have the authority to do things like veto bad budgets, approve or disapprove debt, and restructure the government to some extent. This kind of an approach was used in New York City in the 1970s and in Washington, D.C. in the mid-1990s, and in both cases worked quite well. So that's the first piece of the approach. The second piece of the approach is a restructuring law, and I say restructuring rather than bankruptcy, although it really is a bankruptcy law, because it would not simply add Puerto Rico to Chapter 9, the municipal bankruptcy provisions. It would create, as I think Marcus alluded to, a new territorial restructuring law for both Puerto Rico and its municipalities. And the bill that is pending in Congress, it differs in a few particulars from what Clay Gillette and I have proposed, but it's very similar. And it seems to me that both parts are very important, that any time a public entity gets into this kind of financial distress, there invariably is a governance dysfunction, not just too much debt. And so if you just reduce the debt, you probably haven't fixed the problems. You need to fix some of the problems in governance as well. And the beauty of the proposed legislation, in my view, is that it provides a mechanism for doing that.
Professor Cole, you want to comment before we move to the audience?
So it does provide a mechanism for doing that. The problem is that a lot of these mechanisms are designed to take over fiscal control from the elected representatives. And while that might be okay temporarily, I'm not sure that it would either be constitutional or even politically palatable in the long run. Now, David's plan would also allow for the reinstatement of the Fiscal Control Board if fiscal control is returned to the elected representatives, but they fail to exercise that fiscal control responsibly. It would reinstate the board. I think that runs the danger of permanently disenfranchising the people of Puerto Rico, and frankly, using it as a backstop against runaway spending. So I'm not sure how wise this is. I think in a municipal sense, for New York City and the District of Columbia, those political subdivisions were, as cities, municipalities, those were more, I think, manageable. I expressed my concern to David a few weeks ago about the Oakland School Board situation, where in California, the Oakland School Board was taken over by the state of California because it was so dysfunctional, and there's no prospect of it ever of Oakland ever regaining control of their of their school board. And my concern with the plan is that, given the structure now, that could happen with Puerto Rico.
I was just going to say, Professor Skill, if you could address how long your control board, or even under the proposed legislation, the control board would act, and then who decides whether the government has, in its an ensuing way, acted responsibly or irresponsibly.
So a couple of thoughts on this, and I want to back up one step before I get to the question of how long the control board stays in place, and make the point that although a control board does seem to take away from democracy, it seems to be a disruption of democracy, and Gillette and I are both very much aware of that. They're only used in situations where democracy has broken down. So in a very real sense, a control board can reestablish democracy, and rather than simply being an interference with democracy, it can promote democracy. Now, that's not the point Marcus was making. Marcus was making a point about how long the control board would stay in place. And under our proposal, initially, it would stop once Puerto Rico had met the goals of its fiscal plan and it was running balanced budgets. That would, under our plan, be decided by the control board. So one might have some concerns about that. And we do anticipate that if things break down again in the future, the control board would be reinstated. And I hear Marcus's concerns about that, and I think I would be willing to concede that it might be important to be very careful about what it takes to reinstate it and make that hurdle higher rather than lower. So that would be the first thing I would say. The other thing I would say, just by way of constitutionality, is this a control board with a state, in my view, if Congress were to try to do something like that with a state, would clearly be unconstitutional. But Congress has significantly greater authority over a territory, and I think it's much less likely that you would have a constitutional problem here. You might have a policy problem and a wisdom problem. I don't think it would ultimately be a constitutional problem.
Uh, Let's turn to the audience now. We've got a couple questions pending. I do want to get to Illinois and other states and what might happen there going forward, but two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call of the day.
Hey, Dean, this is Joanne Maduro. My question got answered, which was related to the prospects of the current legislation against this opinion. So I'm exiting.
Okay.
We could probably add to our answer.
Sure.
To that. I mean, I'll just say one thing further, and that is, well, first of all, the legislation at this point seems to have a fairly significant head of steam. So it's passed the House. The Senate is expected to I think it's passed the House. Now I'm drawing a blank. Yeah, it did pass the House. It's expected to be taken up by the Senate soon, and so it has a fairly significant head of steam. I don't think this case is going to slow it down. It could go either way, it seems to me. From the perspective of Puerto Rico has just lost a potential alternative because of this Supreme Court case, that might be a reason to pass the legislation. On the other hand, if you're a bondholder and you're holding out for the prospect of no restructuring option at all, you might dig in your heels even more. So after wrongly predicting what the Supreme Court was going to do, I am not going to predict what I think Congress is going to do. But certainly that this case scrambles things a little bit, at least temporarily.
Professor Marcus Cole,
I would agree. You know, so I'm not a political scientist, so I'm not going to predict either what the Senate will do. But I do think David is right that I think if this decision today increases concern that the only action that can be taken is by Congress, I think that would tend to reinforce the momentum that the bill has.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hey, this is Clint Brown. You guys mentioned in regards to the contract clause that Congress has the power to restructure Puerto Rico's debt. What happens if the investors argue that Congress interfered with their reasonable investment-backed expectations and infringed on their private property rights? Could this lead to a successful takings claim?
So let me be clear. I did not say that the Contracts Clause clearly gives Congress the power to restructure Puerto Rico's debts. What I said was that the Contracts Clause explicitly states that there is a limitation placed on the states themselves to impair contracts. That Contracts Clause restriction does not apply to Congress or to the federal government. Now, it's a separate question as to whether we could call this a taking. While I don't think that this is an abridgment of the Contracts Clause, it could especially since this is a territory of that is essentially controlled by Congress, and it could be characterized as a taking. So I just want to be clear about what I'm saying. I'm saying that there is no restriction on Congress under the Contracts Clause. David?
Yeah, just to chime in, I agree with Marcus's comments, and we'll just go one step further, maybe take them in a slightly different direction. First of all, I think this is a really interesting question. I think there is a potential takings argument. I suspect it would be a little bit difficult to win for a couple of reasons. One is the court has tended to be most protective of pr- property rights where the investment involves collateral. So if these bonds were collateralized and they were going to lose some of the value of the collateral, I think there'd be a very strong takings argument. Now, you don't have to have collateral to have a takings argument. There still is an argument that a restructuring option would interfere with the bondholders' property rights in their investment. Congress, to my knowledge, has not found bankruptcy laws to affect takings in the past. So when municipal bankruptcy was put in place in the 1930s, there weren't, to my knowledge, any successful takings challenges to it. So my guess is that a takings argument would probably fail, but I don't think it's at all a silly argument. I think, as Marcus said, the contracts clause doesn't apply to Congress in the way it applies to the states, but takings jurisprudence does, and I do think there is an argument there. I doubt that it would win, but I wouldn't be completely shocked if it did.
Our lines are once again wide open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. This begins to sound a little bit, or feel a little bit maybe, like the case of the GSEs, Freddie and Fannie, that were bailed out and went into receivership, which I understand to be a sort of form of governance that requires or conservatorship, rather, requires those administering it to conserve the assets, and now the government's in a position of taking all the profits from Freddie and Fannie to the exclusion of the shareholders. Does this begin to seem like that to either of you? And there's takings claims there that are extant right now in the courts.
Yeah, so there are similarities. In my own view, the takings argument is stronger with the GSEs. And so the particular argument, as I know Dean knows, and Marcus probably does as well, is in 2008, Treasury took over the GSEs after having been authorized by Congress, actually Treasury didn't take them over. I guess the GSE regulator took them over. The GSEs were put into conservatorship, and the government bailed them out and took preferred stock in return for the bailout. 4 years later, in 2012, at a time when the GSEs had just started making money again, the terms of the preferred stock that the government held were changed. What it has become known as a sweep was added, and what the sweep does is essentially takes all profits from the GSE and deposits them with the Treasury, so that private investors don't have any chance of recovering anything. In my view, the takings arguments in the GSE case are stronger because the rules of the game were dramatically changed by regulators. The first court that has looked at the GSE takings arguments rejected those arguments, said it wasn't a taking, that the investors had no property right once the GSEs were put into conservatorship, but there is litigation still pending, and there's litigation in particular in the Court of Claims. And to me, those claims are stronger because the government really did change the rules of the game in a way that that changed the investor's position from having a chance of recovery to having no chance of recovery. In this context, in the Puerto Rico context, by contrast, the comparison isn't between recovery and no recovery. It's recovery in a world where Puerto Rico has no bankruptcy option and Puerto Rico might just stop paying you on the one hand versus recovery under a bankruptcy law. And it seems to me much harder to argue that that's a taking, although as I said, I don't think it's a silly argument, and I think it is possible to make the argument.
Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I would agree with David's analysis completely. I think that in the case of the GSEs, the takings clause argument is much stronger. That can be viewed as an expropriation of value, whereas here, what's being contemplated is to have an equitable solution among creditors where they would share pari passu on a smaller pool in the way that they would in a bankruptcy case. So I do think that the takings argument is an interesting one here, particularly since it's a government entity that's claiming this that is being rescued here, and in particular one that is arguably under the control of Congress. I think that the takings argument is not a red-faced argument. It's one that ought to be taken seriously.
Does the taking argument here get stronger, or does it matter if you get down to cents on a dollar? In other words, if the bondholders get 15 cents on a dollar going forward and the pensioners get 75 cents on a dollar, does that matter in a takings claim, or do we want to go that far into the weeds?
No, David, what do you think?
Go ahead, Marcus.
Go ahead, David.
So I was just going to say, I don't think anything would turn on that. It's easier for me to see the takings argument where there's a dramatic disruption of the investors' expectations. I suspect if there was a radically different payout, if bondholders got 5 cents on the dollar and pensions were paid in full, it might make it look more like a taking, but I see that more as an issue of basic principles of bankruptcy or restructuring law. It's what in Chapter 9 is the unfair discrimination provision, and there's a comparable provision in the proposed legislation.
That's a basic principle of bankruptcy law, the fair and equitable principle, and it's in Chapter 9, it's in Chapter 11, and I think David's right. I think that I think the takings clause is implicated with any reduction in payout, but to have uneven payout, I think is really more a matter of bankruptcy principle than it is with regard to the takings clause.
I don't see any more questions from our audience. Again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let me just turn now towards the states. What does today's decision, if anything, mean for some of the states that are in financial distress as we go forward?
David, what do you think?
So I don't think it has – I don't think this case has any implications that that I'm aware of. What has more implications, arguably, although ultimately I don't think it has strong implications, is the proposed legislation. One of the arguments against the proposed legislation is that if Congress gives Puerto Rico the ability to restructure its debts, it's going to have to turn around and give Illinois the right to restructure its debts, because Puerto Rico is very similar to a state. I don't think that is, in fact, the case. I think Puerto Rico as a territory is very different from a state. The proposed legislation only applies to territories. As I noted earlier, Congress has much more authority over territories than it does over states. This was in some respects confirmed and reinforced by the Supreme Court's other Puerto Rico case this term, which was decided last week. It's debatable exactly what the significance of that case is in terms of Puerto Rico, but in terms of Puerto Rico's sovereignty. But it did make clear that Puerto Rico does not have the same status as a state. So I think there is a strong difference between Puerto Rico and the states. And so ultimately, I don't think that the legislation in Congress weighs one way or another with respect to states and whether there will ever be a state bankruptcy. I am of the view that it would be a good thing if there was a bankruptcy framework for the states. I think Marcus is less enthusiastic about that, but I don't think...
Less enthusiastic is an understatement.
I was trying to define your response before you got a chance to. But I don't think the legislation really weighs one way or another on that. And I think Marcus is going to win on the question of whether there will be bankruptcy for states.
So I want to agree for the most part with David. I do want to say that technically this case that came down today has no bearing on the states. But what's interesting about the way the case came down today was that it was a 5-2 decision. And I don't think anyone expected necessarily that Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer would have been in the majority on Justice Thomas's opinion here. And so I do want to do a little tea leaf reading. And I would think that this 5-2 majority might also see any attempt to provide a bankruptcy regime for the states as an unconstitutional exercise. And here's why I say that. David says I'm not enthusiastic about it. I think that a state bankruptcy regime is wholly and completely unconstitutional. The United States isn't. The United States are. The Constitution is a compact between the states themselves. The purpose of the Constitution is to preserve liberty. That's the articulated purpose of the Constitution in the preamble. And part of the way it accomplishes that task is through its structure. It divides power not just between three branches of government, but it divides the locus of power between the state and the federal government. So they are in counterpoise against each other. If you create a bankruptcy regime for the states, are you going to make that just a voluntary bankruptcy regime? And if you do allow for involuntary bankruptcy, are you allowing now the states to be thrown into bankruptcy involuntarily in a way that undermines their ability to counterpoise the power of the federal government? I think it would be wholly inconsistent with the structure of our Constitution. We cannot allow for state bankruptcy under any circumstances. And while it might be nice to allow the states to go on a spending spree, run up their credit cards, and then see if they can be bailed out by Congress, I think that it would be wholly unconstitutional. And I would like to believe that this 5-2 decision today would give me confidence that I'm not the only person who feels this way.
So a couple quick reactions on that. Maybe Marcus and I should do an entire call on state bankruptcy because this is one thing we don't agree on. But a couple things on it. One is I would not envision an involuntary state bankruptcy. So I ultimately think that's a red herring. The real question is, would voluntary state bankruptcy be constitutional? Municipal bankruptcy, by way of comparison, has never been involuntary. There's never been an option of throwing a municipality into bankruptcy against its will, and that would be the case with states as well. Second point I would make is I think it's possible state bankruptcy would be unconstitutional. I actually think it would be constitutional. But I think the arguments for the constitutionality or not of state bankruptcy are the same ones as for municipal bankruptcy. So if state bankruptcy would be unconstitutional as an interference with state sovereignty, I think municipal bankruptcy is unconstitutional as well. If you cannot have state bankruptcy, even if the state is the one that decides whether to invoke it or not, I think municipal bankruptcy is unconstitutional as well. And it municipal bankruptcy has been seen as constitutional for the last 75 years. Finally, in my view, state bankruptcy wouldn't lead to bailouts. It would actually make bailouts less likely. So if you look at a state like Illinois, if there were a bankruptcy option and Illinois could restructure its pensions, I think there would be a lot less pressure for a bailout. But I'm willing to throw all of that overboard and just make the or conclude the way I started, which is by saying I think this is a separate set of arguments. I don't think the Puerto Rico case or the Puerto Rico legislation really goes to the question of state bankruptcy.
I was just going to say, Professor Cole, we do have another question from the audience, but go ahead and respond.
No, I would just say quickly that David's last argument is really a policy argument, the one about the bailouts or not. It's not a constitutional argument. My constitutional argument is that park districts and waste and water districts and electric utilities are not in place to countermand the authority of the central government. The states are designed under our system to provide a balance against the federal government, not municipalities. And so it's a completely different story to have a state bankruptcy from municipal bankruptcy, which I completely agree. Municipal bankruptcy as subdivisions that are there at the will of the states are just like corporations that and therefore constitutional.
Let's take this final question and see if we end up back in Puerto Rico.
Thank you. This is Bob in Maine. I think my question really was just answered because I don't understand the comparison between municipal and state bankruptcies. Since municipalities are creatures of the states are not creatures of the federal government. So I don't think there's any real comparison there.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I don't agree. And I think the better comparison is not a sewer or water district, it's Detroit or Stockton. And it seems to me that the same structural argument that Marcus makes, and I agree that that structural argument is a powerful argument. I think that's if state bankruptcy were unconstitutional, I think it would be because of that structural argument that despite the state's consent, there is an argument that state sovereignty serves a structural role, and that structural role cannot be addressed through state consent. I think it's the same argument with Detroit and whether Detroit can file for bankruptcy. Effectively, by allowing Detroit to file for bankruptcy, we're changing the nature of the state of Michigan. And although the effect is less direct, I think it's the same kind of effect. Congress is coming in and altering the state structure, not the state, the structure of Michigan as a state, but Michigan plus its municipalities and how it regulates its municipalities. And I really don't see the distinction between the two. I think either they're both unconstitutional or they're both constitutional.
Well, gentlemen, you've both been very generous with your time. We've got a couple minutes left, so let me give each of you 60 seconds to wrap up. We'll start with Professor Cole and end with Professor Skill. Professor Cole.
So I think today's decision involving Puerto Rico is really a straightforward reading of the bankruptcy code as it applies to Puerto Rico's situation. I do think that all of the courts reviewed this question or have been in complete agreement that it's inappropriate for Puerto Rico to exercise this power on its own. And I think that if there's going to be a solution for Puerto Rico, it has to come from Congress. And I also agree with David that I don't think that a solution for Puerto Rico that comes from Congress sets any precedent for the states, because I don't see a parallel between the territory and the states. And finally, I think that any attempt by Congress to enact a bankruptcy law for the states would be unconstitutional. I think that to do so would require an amendment of the Constitution, would completely undermine the structure of the Constitution and the purpose of the relationship between the states and the federal government. David?
So I was all set to say I agree with everything Marcus said. So I'll say I agree with everything Marcus said except about state bankruptcy, and I'll just push that to one side. I do think that the Supreme Court decision was a straightforward reading of the statute. It was the reading that that had been adopted by the lower courts. It is a very plausible reading. I personally don't think it's the best reading, but I do think it's a plausible reading. The one thing I would say is at oral arguments, the lawyer for Puerto Rico made a very interesting plain meaning argument in favor of Puerto Rico's position. And the argument was, as I think I mentioned earlier, that the provision 109C that determines who can be a debtor in Chapter 9 is a gateway to Chapter 9. And if you are excluded from that provision, as Puerto Rico is, none of Chapter 9 applies to you. I thought it was a very interesting and I thought it was a compelling argument. What ended up happening with it, obviously it got rejected. The language that the lawyer used, the gateway language, got picked up by the Supreme Court in both the majority and the dissent, but the rationale of the language did not. And Justice Thomas's opinion for the 5-2 majority, as Marcus said, it's a very just the facts, ma'am, kind of opinion, very, or just the law, I suppose, kind of opinion, straightforward and consistent with the kinds of opinions that Justice Thomas has written in several other key bankruptcy cases. There have been several cases where the code could plausibly be read to help debtors out, and Justice Thomas has issued very straightforward opinion saying that that's not what the code says.
Well, gentlemen, we're going to leave it right there if we could. My thanks to both Professor David Skeel and Professor Marcus Cole. Some apologies to the audience for some technical difficulties we experienced during the call, at least the early parts of the call. A reminder to the audience to dial into our next Teleform conference call. That'll be tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, as we'll be discussing Halo Electronics. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.